Well, good evening. I feel like I come to you in much weakness and trembling. If I look like I had 2.5 hours of sleep last night, drove to Kennebunkport, spent most of the day throwing up on a ship and driving back home, you've guessed correctly. Because of that, I've also about lost my voice. So please bear with me. I will try to still make this interesting and hopefully informative too. I know it's annoying to listen to something like this, but just look past it for tonight. Let's pray. Lord, I thank you for this evening that we can come together again to look into your word and more the mechanics of the scriptures rather than what's written therein. But Lord, I pray that you would just strengthen our faith through this. Would you open our eyes and help us to delight more in what we have because of what we know. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so tonight I'm going to be sharing on two different things. Thanks, Dad. I am going to be looking at textual criticism and then also how we get the Bible that we have today. In my slog, I forgot to bring my own Bible, but I'm not going to be reading from it, but just I have my Greek New Testament with me, how we get our actual, what we read for devotions in the morning. At some point, I would encourage you to also do your own studies on some other topics that we could have looked into, but for now, we're just going to stick with what we have here. So today, I want to look into textual criticism. I want to define that because when I talked about textual criticism, some people think of higher German criticism, which is higher criticism, which comes from Germany, where they look at the text and basically are saying, we don't think this is what Jesus really said, and we don't think this is true, we don't think this is true. And basically, they're just kind of doing away with the Bible till they have about 5 to maybe 10% of what they said was actual fact. All that is based on pretty much subjectivity. And so we're not doing that. Today we're looking at this definition, the study of the copies of any written document whose original, going back to the autograph, is unknown or non-existent for the primary purpose of determining the exact wording of the original. And there's some interesting things because of this study, because we can do, or why we can do textual criticism. One, if we actually had the original autograph, we wouldn't need to do textual criticism because we know. In like manner, if every single copy we had was identical to the letter, we wouldn't need textual criticism either. And actually, we wouldn't even, at that point, be able to know if what we have is true to the original. The Muslims do have different versions of the Quran, although if you talk to any of them, they'll say it's all one. There was a time that one of their caliphs realized that there's different scriptures being quoted from the Quran. And so he gathered people together and he wrote down, like he said, okay, quote your portion. He write it down. And when different opinions came, he tells some, hey, you stop quoting that. You're not allowed to do that anymore. That's the wrong one. And he tried to narrow it down to one. And any differing copies of the Quran were burned to try to do away with any type of textual criticism. So while you can somewhat do a bit of textual criticism on the Quran, because of that time in history where Islam was consolidated to one small remote area, and they were able to do this very early on, they were able to get rid of a lot of copies. So nowadays, scholars looking at the Quran have no idea really what the original said. But when it comes to Christianity, the scriptures went far and wide. And I'll have a map here pretty soon of the Roman Empire. And you can see how far these copies would have circulated from. And there's no way at all that they could have all been brought together, like some say, at the Council of Nicaea in 325, and decided, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to add in the deity of Christ. We're going to do all this stuff. 250 years after, texts have been circulating throughout all of the Roman world. When it comes to how many manuscripts we have, especially when it comes to the ancient world, we have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to how many manuscripts we have, and not just how many we have, but how early. We've touched on this before, but it's good to just keep bringing it to mind. When it comes to just Greek manuscripts, we have over 5,400. This doesn't mean that we have 5,400 New Testaments. It doesn't mean that we have 5,400 complete books like Matthew, Mark, Luke. But it does mean we have some full New Testaments, some full books, some full pages, and some full verses. And yet, whenever you take all that in connection together, we still have a wide range. Now, Greek was the common language of the Roman Empire because they had taken over the Greek Empire, if you know your history. But Latin was the official language. And so in official settings, especially after the church became legalized in the Roman Empire, you start seeing tons and tons and thousands of Latin manuscripts being written, so translated from Greek and Hebrew, and distributed throughout the Roman world. We have over 10,000 copies of those. We also have between 5 and 10,000. I should be able to narrow that down, but for lack of time, I just took that round number of New Testament manuscripts in other languages. So remember, the Romans conquered a lot. They conquered Great Britain. They had parts of North Africa. They had just a wide range. And so, of course, they're going to speak other ones like Coptic, which would have been spoken in Egypt. It's basically Egyptian hieroglyphics with Greek letters. Syriac, Gorgonian, Armenian, Hebrew. So we have lots of copies as well. And even if somebody was able to destroy all of those manuscripts, you know, a lot of these are housed in single buildings. So if somebody wanted to be really mean and blow up a bunch, we could lose a lot of this in a single day. But even if this was somehow all taken away, we have over 1 million quotes from early church fathers starting in 150 AD, which is within 100 years from when most of these books were written, that we could entirely reconstruct the New Testament several times over and have our own, we could do our own textual criticism from just them, because they wrote exponentially on this. You have people like Origen, who wrote 15-page books on Revelation, and others who wrote books and books and dissertations on the Pauline epistles. And so they quoted them many, many, many times. And looking at the evidence of, okay, so we have a manuscript just come in. I was going to say fresh off the press, but that actually doesn't apply here. We got this old manuscript we find. We're going to look at two types of evidence to kind of judge what kind of manuscript is this. Is this a trustworthy one or is it not? There's the external and the internal. When it comes to external, it's the hard copy of the paper itself. Date. How old is it? There's ways to do it. Most of the time, it's by destroying it, just a tiny piece of it. But they can also look at the letters, because many scribes were paid and trained scribes. Somebody highly trained in scriptology, if I just made that word up, forgive me, but looking at type and how people wrote letters, they can guess within 50 years when this was written, based on schools and how people were able to curve their thoughts. Think about your grandparents' writing. My grandma had long, nice cursive, like, shh, 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 shh. I'm guessing a lot of your relatives did too. That's very common for the, you know, during the war period. More clerical writing, late 1800s, and maybe even earlier. So even we who aren't trained kind of know that's an old person writing that versus that's somebody who never learned cursive in school. We can start saying these things and somebody trained would know even better. Generally, the older is assumed to be a better, but it's not always the better one. We also want to look at where it comes from, which is coming later. But we also want to see how carefully the manuscripts were copied. I think I mentioned this before, but based on the errors we can find, we can see if somebody was taking like a whole sentence, and okay, in the beginning God created heaven and earth. In the beginning God created heaven and earth. And maybe by doing that, they're kind of doing it just by how they memorized something, and so things can get tweaked that way. We can see if they did it word by word, and often whenever that happens, we start seeing repetition of words, or maybe a deduction of a word. We'll look into that again later. Or if somebody is doing it letter by letter, which is crazy long, but a pretty thorough way of doing it. So we want to look at how it's written, the paper it's written on, if it's papyrus, or if it's an actual manuscript, which would be a leather skin. We also want to look at its genealogical solidarity. So manuscripts, because they're copied from each other, there might be one manuscript that ended up somewhere in the heart of Turkey that got copied 50 times. And those 50 copies each got copied 50 times. And so suddenly we have from the one family tree that if the grandma, if you will, had some flaws, all the daughters and granddaughters, I don't know why, but they're talked about in she. Hebrew and Greek have he and she, so maybe that's where it comes in. But anyway, we can begin to see, oh, this is in this particular family. This region or this family has this certain characteristics. And so it's fascinating whenever we find something in Egypt that seems like it was copied from somewhere in Syria. You know, somebody must have traveled with it, you know, and it ended up somewhere else. I don't know, maybe lent it or gave it away to a buddy. But we also want to know what kind of family tree is this? Is this a reliable family tree? Is there one that people really didn't care? They just kind of wanted some scripture, and so they just kind of hastily wrote this down, and this is the family tree they have. And then three, the geological distribution. Where are these manuscripts coming from? There are certain areas that were known to have more heretical teaching. And in that, when you're copying, if you want to try to bend a particular theological sway, you can do that a little bit by what you add or how you word something. Not that that happened a lot, but it happened some. And so we just kind of want to know where are these coming from. So just looking at the external evidence. The internal evidence, you know what? That was internal. Geographical is just simply where it's coming from. Forgive me, I'm getting too deep. The intrinsic possibility, so we're going to look at, I think, two probabilities. So this is what the scribes likely would have or have done. They want to look at what the biblical author, we want to try to figure out what the biblical author is likely to have written and see where maybe people added later, for this is the theological then. So for instance, this may blow some of you away. I know in class, I was blown away a lot and I did a lot of studying and I verified it. This doesn't change any of our doctrine. There's teaching all through scripture that we can still argue this passage, but I'm going to just go right in here. So here's an example of a textual criticism. Romans 8:1. The earliest manuscripts all say, there is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. End. Later on, it seems like there were some people who thought, ooh. Even though Paul goes on to say later that they can't be walking in the flesh, that statement is pretty bold. And so it seems like one scribe thought, you know what? We should make this clear. This isn't just free willy, you know, just grace, you know, coming out for no matter what. We need a qualifier. So they put in, who do not walk according to the flesh. Makes sense, right? There's therefore no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus who do not walk according to the flesh. Okay. But later on, some people wanted positive. It's not just those who don't walk in this according to the flesh, but they also need to be walking according to the Spirit. And so we can actually begin to see where things have been added to texts. Another one, this is a very long portion, so this is just a few phrases. But the woman caught in adultery is found in various parts of John, at the end of Luke, and in many manuscripts not mentioned at all. Especially the early ones, it's not anywhere. And so we can safely say that story is not in the original scriptures. Now, there are theories. One of the theories that I like is that this is a story that people knew because John himself said, you know, if I told you everything that Jesus did, the world couldn't contain the books there. It's just, it's so much. So he, you know, they limited what they wrote based on what they felt like or the Holy Spirit led them to write that we would need. But there must have been some stories still floating around about Jesus. And this is a story that maybe some scribes were like, you know what? We're getting martyred pretty thick. And we don't want the story to disappear. Maybe we should put it in the text somewhere so that way it's remembered. And potentially that's what could have happened. It's a likely possibility. All right, transcriptional probability, what the scribes likely have written when copying their exemplar. This is more mistakes, not a bend to a certain thing, but just kind of accidental. So, Mark and Matthew, for instance, are very closely related. Mark, I've heard, says about 90% of what Matthew states. And in such a situation, if somebody is very well acquainted with Mark and they're translated Matthew, or vice versa, because they're so closely related, it could be very easy to just start writing verbatim what the other gospel said. It's not changing the meaning of the text, but it is altering it to where it's saying in different words the same thing. There are also scribes who did not know Greek very well, so they're trying to translate and transcribe, not translate, but transcribe or copy a text that they're not so familiar with. It's possible that they have poor eyesight. You know, they're not working with good electricity. It could be that it's dark, and so they're having a harder time seeing. Poor hearing. Something common in those days was to have one guy reading the text and maybe have 10 copiers out there, and they're all writing down. So maybe somebody's there, didn't hear real well. He doesn't want to raise his hand and say, can you read that again? So he wrote down what he thought he heard. Maybe they're just tired or simply being sloppy. You know, 5 o'clock's coming around the corner. They want to get home. They got to finish this page. And so they just rush, and there it is. Variations. I'm going to be saying this a fair amount when we're here. So I want to make sure that we understand what it is. A wrong definition of variant, which was used for well over 100 years and much to the detriment of many Christians, unfortunately. Things that, like the Jesus Seminar, Bart Ehrman, and other scholars that are anti-inerrancy are putting forward, and that is counting each manuscript as different wording from others. So if you have one manuscript that differs, and you have 30,000, what they're doing is they're counting that as 30,000 variants. And you can imagine with how many variants we're going to end up looking at. The number becomes astronomical. And so people use that astronomical number to say, we have no idea what's in the text. It's been changed and altered so many times. We don't know. So whatever's true to you or true in your heart or whatever, just take that. Just use it as a guidebook. The right definition, this is one that Dan Wallace puts out that I appreciate. Dan Wallace is one of the leading scholars for New Testament criticism and an amazing Greek scholar. He says that we should count each difference in wording regardless how many manuscripts have the variant. So if there's one difference, it's one. It's not 30,000, it's one. That number still becomes big as we see, but nothing near approaching to what others have said. So there's five types of these variants. One is omission, lacks a word, or more than one word. And we'll look at some examples here soon, if I remember it. There's additions, the opposite, adding one or more words. Transposition, so word order, Jesus Christ versus Christ Jesus. Does that change the meaning at all? No, not one bit. Substitution, replacing one or more words for other words, Jesus versus Lord. So in this instance, in the original, I say this carefully, as best we know, in the original Gospel of John, John did not call Jesus Lord till after his resurrection. And it seems like later on, people wanted to make sure that we knew that we honor Christ as Lord. And so whenever it says Jesus, they just substituted Lord just to make sure, you know, again, people know we acknowledge him as our Messiah. It doesn't change the meaning, but it does change the wording. So it's a variant. And then five, a total rewrite. Something very different than what would have been original. Two of the very most common are haplography and didography. The one is just writing once, which should have been written twice. For instance, in this text in 1 John 2:23, this scribe wrote, whoever confesses the Son, and totally skipped also has the Father, and kind of jumped over to whoever denies the Son does not have the Father. Could be that he saw the ton uion, which is the Son, and saw that again over there, and just kind of skipped over it, but this is a very famous one. And then also didography, writing twice, which should have been written once. Here's an example from Luke 1:28, where when Gabriel comes to Mary, he says, "Greetings, favored one, favored one." He probably didn't say it twice. The scribe accidentally, he probably was copying word for word and just accidentally did this. I do this in my own typing for papers. Thankfully, there's spell check today, so I can easily see. I'm glad I don't have to use a typewriter. But these people were not using that. They were writing with their hands. All right, example from Mark 1, 2 through 3. Here's another example. "As it is written in Isaiah the prophet, behold, I send my messenger before your face who will prepare your way. Behold, I send my messenger before your face who will prepare your way." So they just totally wrote that whole sentence out a second time. Some other examples of variants. Sometimes incorrect grammar was used. And we got to remember the people that wrote the books of the New Testament weren't all necessarily, doesn't appear like they were all probably like professional Greek speakers or even mother tongue Greek speakers. And so if some were writing themselves, it's very possible that some of their grammar sounded a little bit off. And for a professionally trained scribe, that would just, like ultimate OCD to have to rewrite, like to copy out bad grammar. And so it's, there are times that we see where bad grammar is changed or corrected to correct grammar. There's also, here's another example. In Matthew 27, 16 through 17, when Pilate was bringing out Jesus at that time, they had a well-known prisoner whose name was Jesus Barabbas. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, which one do you want me to release to you, Jesus Barabbas or Jesus who is called the Messiah? Well, in the King James Version, we actually don't see Jesus Barabbas, we just see Barabbas. In more modern translations, you will see Jesus Barabbas. Again, going to origin, which I have appreciation for, but also not so much appreciation for. Origen is an early Greek Christian philosopher who did some good things and some not necessarily great things for the early church. I think he lived in the 3rd century, if I'm remembering right. But he specifically said, no unrighteous person ever took the name Jesus. And it was a common thought back then, because Jesus was Lord, at least it seemed like for the Greeks, Jesus is actually a very popular name. My name is Jesus, technically. It's just been transliterated to Joshua. But some people saw this and were like, ooh, Jesus Barabbas sharing the same name as Jesus the Christ? Oh, that sounds bad. And so they're just, scratch it out. Forget Jesus and just write Barabbas. But we not only can look in the text, but even it makes sense here whenever we look at Jesus Barabbas or Jesus who is called the Messiah. Pilate had to give some qualifier to say, which Jesus? Here's Jesus Barabbas and then Jesus who is called the Messiah. Another one, in Romans 5:1, this would be probably a hearing problem. In Romans 5:1, it says, we have peace with God. Or it could say, let us have peace with God. In Greek, it's just this one letter right here. This is Omicron, and this is Omega. This is pronounced Echomen, and this is pronounced Echomen. So if you heard that, you'd have to wonder, okay, wait a minute. One's indicative and one's subjunctive. And so some scribes probably wrote it with an Omicron, which is probably correct. And some people wrote it with the Omega. So that's, they both have the same sound, but if you're just saying it, and we have those same words in English. Thankfully, context, I feel like in most of our English words, I didn't think about it too much, but it would help us a bit more. But in this case, it can be confusing. Typically, scholars have decided that the most difficult reading is generally, not always, but generally accepted as the most likely reading. The reason for that is simply, if it sounds a little bit rough or raises some questions, over the course of at least 1,000 years between when it was written up until the Middle Ages, so 1,500 years, it's very likely that scribes would have tried to smooth it out. And that's what we end up seeing oftentimes. Smoothing out of spelling, smoothing out of grammar, smoothing out of, if somebody thinks that this sounds theologically sketchy, we'll add in a little bit to make it better. So the most difficult reading is generally accepted as most likely reading. Again, hear that word generally, not always, but generally. All right, Some amazing things began to happen in the Middle Ages. In 1440, the Gutenberg press was invented. It wasn't used to write a book till later. But all writing, you have to remember, before that time was handwritten. Because of this, no two copies are exactly alike. They're going to vary in how well people write, in how well people can spell. There's all kinds of differences. But before that time, no two copies could be the same. And also, because of this, copies were expensive. They were well cared for. They were used for a very long time. They were revered. If you're going to go to the hassle of taking 3 years to copy a book, you're probably going to put that on a top shelf and not use it whenever you're drinking coffee. All right, the most common variants are forms of spelling. I think later on I have percentages. For since he opened was spelled three different ways in the space of 8 verses in one manuscript of John. Based on my research and what I've heard scholars say, they didn't have dictionaries back then. There's kind of a generalized way of spelling things, but no official, you know, no Webster hadn't come around yet to straighten out the Greeks. And so there's going to be different spellings. So even one scribe in the space of these 8 verses translated, he opened, or he wrote it down 3 different ways. I guess you could probably see, but here you have alpha versus eta. They're both vowels. And then here, instead of epsilon and omega, we have omicron, iota. Same thing. It's going to make roughly the same sound whenever you pronounce it, but still 3 different spellings. And so we call this 3 variants. Some would like to say this is like 90,000 variants because they might differ with that many other ways. Another way is the movable nu. Now the V in Greek makes the N sound. We use it a lot, like whenever we say Noah built an ark, because the next word after A starts my mind is shot. Sorry. Not a consonant, but a vowel. Thank you. We put an N there. In Greek, it's the same way. A dog, an ark. So, for instance, in Greek, if a word is ending, so there are many words that if they're ending with a vowel and are beginning another word with a vowel, then they'll put a new in there. Now, they did this earlier on. You'd see this more common, and as time went on, they began dropping out a lot of the movable nous. But here's just one example. Here, Esti o Iesus, estin o anthropos. So he is Jesus versus he is the man or man. But pointing out especially the new. Also names are variant spelling a lot too. This is the name of John in Greek, Ioannes. You see here's 2 nous and here is just 1. Does it change the meaning? Not one bit. Is it a difference? Yes. Is it a meaningful difference? Not at all. And we'll talk about meaning as well. Greek is both amazing and extremely frustrating, at least for me. Greek loves how specific their verbs are and their cases. And so we have this little phrase or sentence here, John loves Mary. If we change it around, it doesn't make any sense. Loves John Mary. You can kind of say, oh, loves John. Okay, maybe John loves Mary. But if we say Mary loves John, that doesn't mean that John loves Mary. It means Mary does. But in Greek, based on the case of that verb right here, this isn't the dative case with this iota subscript. It doesn't matter how we rearrange this. Ioannes agape Marion versus Ioannes Marion agape. Agape Ioannes Marion. We can change that 6 different times. It all will always translate in English, John loves Mary. Articles are nice in Greek. It helps you remember, like, okay, this is in the nominative form. But it doesn't have to be there. But we could throw it in there. And if we add it in there, it still means John loves Mary. If we make the object, give the object an article, it's still going to mean John loves Mary. And if we get both articles, it's still going to mean John loves Mary. Always in English. Anytime I'd have a Greek exam and I have to translate any of this, this is the only correct answer. I could write literally, the John loves the Mary, but my Greek professor wants me to. There are times for that. It'll say, translate this literally, and other times it'll say, give a good translation. Okay, so here we have, in each block, 6 word order. We have just 2 verb choices, and we have 3 forms of Mary. We have the article combinations, verb form variations, optional pronouns. This, just by itself, could have 576 variations, not even counting spelling variations. We didn't even put in, instead of agape, I could use phileo, or phile, which is another word for love in Greek, and it still would mean John loves Mary. So you can see very quickly, variants can compound astronomically. But in any case, it's still going to mean the same thing. All right, let's get into more nitty-gritty. Hope not to bore you with too many stats here. But there's roughly 140,000 words in the Greek New Testament. There's roughly 400,000 to 500,000 variants. Now you can say, wait a minute, that means there are more variants than we have words in the Greek New Testament. True. But here's the thing. If we had one manuscript only, we would have 0 variants because the text would agree with itself. As soon as we have a second text, now we can compare. We can go, oh, here's some variants. If we have 3, now we just added more. And if you do math and cubing and square roots and all that stuff that blows your mind when you're high school, imagine if you had 30,000 manuscripts. This number very quickly does become big. And it's actually amazing that it's not potentially worse. Dan Wallace, I'm not sure if he's the one that put this together for the categories of textual variants, but he is at least a proponent of it. There are those that are neither meaningful or viable. Meaningful meaning that it actually changes the meaning. Viable meaning that it's possibility of going back to the original. Juanes spelled different ways isn't going to make any difference. It's neither meaningful or viable. There are those that are not meaningful but are viable. There are those that are not viable but are meaningful. And there are those that are both meaningful and viable.
So viable again?
Viable means that it's most likely going back to the original. Like,
that gets right.
Yeah, right. It's, let me get my wheels turning here. Basically, yeah, just what's the possibility of it going back to the original? Some things are important to figure out if they're viable, others not. Whether Ioannis was spelt with 1 nu or 2. My mom wanted to make sure my brother Nathaniel was spelt biblically, so she spelled Nathanael instead of Iel. It's translated from Greek, so I don't really know if it makes a difference. That's how they spelled it back in King James English. That's neither meaningful nor viable. At least that's how I'm reading this.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. We'll look at what those actually mean. So 75% of all of those are just simply spelling changes. You have to understand a lot of people are learning Greek. So a lot of new people are trying to write Greek. There's not necessarily a specific way to spell. And so whenever you have Armenians learning Greek, and Coptics learning Greek, and Gorgonians learning Greek, and Celtics learning Greek, then it's going to change. And so you're going to have lots of spelling changes. None of those spelling changes are virtually none. There's a few, like echomen, like I mentioned, we have versus let us have, that could have some meaning changes. But overall, it's not. And most common is that movable nu, that V that I pointed out. The older manuscripts did not drop that, while newer ones did. language evolves, and so you can expect that to happen. About 25% are meaningful, but not viable. So in this example from 1 Thessalonians 2:7, we have manuscripts that say three different things. There's a manuscript that says, we were gentle among you. There's a manuscript that says, we were little children among you. And there's a manuscript that says, we were horses among you. Now, it doesn't take much common sense, especially whenever you're reading the rest, to realize we were gentle among you is probably the most common. The differences in these Greek words are ipioi, nepioi, and hipioi. So very similar. They look similar. And depending on how the scribe was feeling that day, he may have just accidentally kind of wrote down a similar spelled word. So, yeah, it would make a difference if Paul and I think it's Silas and Timotheus in Thessalonians, if they had come to them as little children, what could that mean? Were they wild running around? Were they just really humble and meek? Or what was the meaning of this? And we were horses among you. I don't know what kind of sermon you'd preach on that one. But we were gentle among you makes the most sense, especially because it goes on to say, if I remember the text right, as nursing mothers to her children. So how could we be little children as nursing mothers to children? And then less than 1/5% are meaningful and viable. So, for instance, in Revelation 13:18, we have the number of the beast. I think I mentioned this before at 666, and where one variant, actually there's two of our oldest texts, say 616. And this is based, that we've deduced that these numbers are made off of how you spell Caesar, Nero, Caesar, in Hebrew versus Greek. If you spell it in Greek, you get 666, and if you spell it in Hebrew, then it's 616. In Mark 9:29, we also have this, and he said to them, this kind can come forth by nothing but by prayer. Full stop. That's what appears like the original text would say. But we're not actually sure. We have a lot of texts that are very credible that also add and fasting. So if you don't like to fast, maybe you'd like the one text a little better than the other one. So this is meaningful. It is meaningful and viable. But I'm going to have to go look deeper into what viable means. I appreciate you asking that. My brain's shut down there. Early church fathers discussed early variants as well and what they consider the better reading. So not only do we have all these manuscripts, but there are also some things like, for instance, the number of the beast that one of the early church fathers said, there's this version going around saying it's 616, but it's actually 666. That is wrong. And it's fascinating whenever we find that. Now we have to take those early church fathers' words with a grain of salt. We don't know always why they maybe didn't like something, but if they didn't, we need to beware. In the Hebrew text, here's a very common, here's a very interesting one. I don't read Hebrew, but I put it on there just for fun. Literally, this text is translated Saul, son, year, and reign 2 years over Israel. What does that mean? In the King James, they wrote down Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, so on. Doesn't really make a lot of sense. The NIV says Saul was 1 year old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel 2 years. I mean, I would not send my 1 year old out seeking my mules if they got lost, but he must have been pretty mature for his age. So this doesn't really make sense either. And then the ESV just simply says Saul was ... years old and began to reign. He reigned over Israel 2 years. Because we actually don't know what this text is trying to say. And we don't have any text that clarifies this. Whenever they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, this is one of the texts that they ran to. Like, maybe we can finally fix this. And unfortunately, they didn't. But this isn't going to change any of our theology. Our salvation doesn't depend on how old Saul was when he began to reign. That concludes our first part. I'm going to try to rush through this and try to give it just a brief history of Bible translations. So in my hands here, I've got a handy-dandy NA28 Novus Testium, or however they say that. This is the Greek New Testament. But this is a compilation of many, many, many. We don't just use one, we didn't just find the Greek New Testament from ancient times and now we've got it and we can translate our beautifully King James Version Bible and know this is it. There's a lot of languages in the Roman Empire. Roman Empire was very big. And as I mentioned before, there's a lot of languages spoken throughout it. After Christianity was promoted, or at least sanctioned by the Roman government in the 300s or the early 4th century, there was a need for people to begin to read the Bible for themselves. And many people at this point in history were not understanding Greek very well, but knew Latin. So the church wanted to have a Latin that was, have a Bible that people could understand. There were Latin Bibles available, but they were inconsistent, they had a lot of errors in them, and they're often poorly translated. You know, somebody probably went to Moody for 2 years, thought he could understand Greek, and then started translating into Latin. He knew enough to kind of start studying, but he didn't know how to do a very good version. And so he was sanctioned by the local pope and the church leaders, Pope Damascus, to do this version, to put together what is now known as the Latin Vulgate. Interestingly enough, Jerome traveled to Israel to learn Greek, specifically from Bethlehem, to learn Hebrew, pardon. So Jerome went to Israel, to Bethlehem, to learn Hebrew, and he was also a great Greek student. And he went from the Greek texts into Latin and created a pretty solid book or translation called the Latin Vulgate, which is simply the common Latin Bible. And this was used for many, many years. It became so well familiar with people that even as people started walking away from Latin, that was their... I'm going to be hard on King James versions today. Somewhat sorry, but not totally. But that was their King James Bible of the day. There were phrases that they knew that were in the Latin text that they just loved, and that's what they were familiar with. And the church people had been preaching from it for so long, the elders, that it was just Latin was it. Even as people began to not know Latin anymore. Well, people debate when the Renaissance period began, but it seems likely that it began around the time when the Ottoman Empire overtook the Byzantine Empire in 1453. So remember, after Constantine died, the Roman government started falling apart. I think if I remember history right, it fell into four parts, two generals killed each other, whatever, and became two parts. But eventually we have the Western Empire and the Eastern Empire. The Western Empire eventually gravitated toward Latin, and the Greek and the Eastern stayed with the Greek. Well, when the Muslims started leaving Saudi Arabia at the end of the 8th century and taking over more, start taking over what used to be the Roman Empire, at this point the Byzantine Empire, they eventually overtook Constantinople, and when that fell, that was the end of the Byzantine Empire. The Muslims, depending on who you want to believe, were either nice and kind, or rather not nice or kind to who they captured, and I'll leave that to you to decide. But there was a host of refugees coming into the Western Roman Empire, fleeing the rise of the Muslims. And with them, they brought ancient Greek classical literature, like Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, and also their beloved Greek New Testaments. At this time, there was a surge with the Renaissance period. Scholars, college students, those that were learned, humanitarians, were saying, we need to go back to the sources, ad fontes in Latin. And because of this Greek influx of manuscripts, there was renewed interest into the Greek text, the New Testament itself. So for over 1,000 years, Western Europe, the Latin Vulgate was the Bible, not a Bible, it was the Bible. There's no other Bibles allowed. That was the only one, and priests and monks were really the only ones that were supposed to be reading it. And few in the West knew Greek well enough to work directly with the New Testament's original language, and there weren't many Greek manuscripts around either. So they pretty much had the Latin Bible. Humanist scholars of the Renaissance began advocating for return to the sources, meaning studying scriptures in the original Hebrew and Greek language. By late 1400s, some Greek manuscripts had made their way into Western Europe, but no printed edition of the Greek New Testament existed. Remember, this is also the time that the Gutenberg Press just was made. So fascinating time for this all to happen. Erasmus was a leading Christian humanist that badly wanted to see reform in the church. He was like the Martin Luther of the day, except instead of trying to break out, he wanted to reform the church from within. And he thought that having an accurate Bible might actually help bring that in. So he wanted a text that reflected what the apostles actually wrote in the Greek, not some translated Latin version. Now remember, this is a time where they couldn't drive 60 miles in an hour and go pick up a box full of books to bring home to study. And he had to travel to go find manuscripts. Travel wasn't easy, and they didn't have a lot of manuscripts, but he was able to come up with 12 Greek manuscripts, all from 1000 to 1280. So we're not talking about old. You know, he's doing this in the early 1500s, so they're old for the time, but not when compared to how early these books were written. He also had two. Do I have this written in here? No, I'm sorry, I'm thinking of King James Bible translation. So he had 12 Greek manuscripts, but he was missing the book of Revelation. But he had a Latin commentary that had a Greek text of the Roman of the book of Revelation in Greek in it. So he, you know, in the footnotes there was all this Greek, and so he would try to take from that. But the last few pages of this commentary were missing. So what he ended up doing is he just took the Latin Vulgate and back translated it into Greek. And in doing this, he created some readings that never existed in any manuscript before. For instance, the Book of Life versus the Tree of Life. Again, not a doctrinal change, but definitely if you're looking for a book and find a tree or vice versa, you know, it could make you confused in heaven, potentially. But despite its flaws, he managed to get it finished in 1516. Now, this wasn't legal for him to do. Other people had lost their heads for this. And so he very wisely dedicated it to the Pope. And once it was dedicated to the Pope really couldn't do much except accept it. So there they had the first Greek New Testament. There was another copy, another work going, and he rushed to get, he wanted his to be out first, or technically his printer did. He saw dollar signs, or whatever the money they were using at the time. So it was a bit rushed, but he managed to get it done. He presented it to the Pope. Now, because it was rushed, it had some flaws, he revised it. But then, people reading the Greek really didn't like that some of what it said differed from the Latin Vulgate. And Latin Vulgate, you know, was pretty dear to their hearts, had been for quite a long time. And so there's a lot of pressure on Erasmus to make it say what the Latin says. And so he begrudgingly changed a few things to make it read like the Latin. And he ended up revising it a total of 4 times. After this, a gentleman, Stephanus is his Latinized name, took this Greek and added verse numbers. I know chapter numbers were written in before, but I forget. But the first Greek, the Bible is not written with chapter and verse headings. You have to understand it was just all one long, just a book. And also, in early Greek, there's no spaces or even punctuation marks. So it can be really confusing if you want to go and read a Greek, old Greek text. You have to know Greek pretty well. Better than, I mean, I've only had 1 year and it's super confusing for me. I don't even do it. It's a headache to try to figure out where one word starts and the next begin. Beza, who is somehow related to Martin Luther, advisor or so, revised this Greek text between 1565 and 1604. And then some other Germans also printed their own Greek New Testaments. These brothers, when they did, they in the very beginning, they wrote down, "Therefore you have the text now received by all." Kind of a bold statement, but they wanted to make sure their copy was the one that everybody received. And that's whenever, because of textum, ergos, habes, nunc, omnibus, receptum. My Latin is terrible, forgive me. But you get textus, receptus. All right, so what do we use for current translations? We use the NA 28. this is a compilation of as many Greek manuscripts as we know we have currently, so thousands, and using textual criticism, try to put in the best copy we can. So this book is representing thousands of fragmented pieces, whole books, or even various parts. And for the New Testament, the Old Testament, I haven't dug deep into it, but we use the Masoretic text, which is the oldest complete Hebrew script we have. I think it's from like 1008, somewhere around there, AD. And we cross-reference it with the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are much older, and also with the Greek Septuagint. I think I talked about the Greek Septuagint before, so I'm not going to go into it again. All right, I'm going to try to rush here to the end. Spencer, you want a job? And Soraya, do you want a job too? Soraya, can you hand one of these to each person on this side? And Spence, and one of these person on that. Thank you. All right. I'm not going to go over this whole page, but you might find this interesting. And I hope my numbers all line up the same on this. But as best we know, the first English translation started happening in the 600s when a monk in England translated some psalms to be sung in English. Later on, a gentleman by the name of Bede translated the Gospels in English and finished in AD 735. And according to legend, he finished the Gospel of John on his deathbed, and as he breathed the last translation, he said, "It is finished," and died. Beautiful story. May not have happened, but in any case, he did translate the New Testament into English. Alfred the Great wanted his people to also be able to read the scriptures, so he translated the entire Psalms and the Ten Commandments in the 9th century. John Wycliffe was a teacher, if I remember right, at Oxford, and he had a burden for people to also be able to read the scriptures. There's some other translation stuff that you might see in your papers I'm skipping over. I'm trying to just hit the mountaintops, if you will, and not look at all the hills. He badly wanted it, and so he translated the entire Bible, but he did it from Latin. And the Catholic Church didn't like it. Later on, when they condemned Huss, John Huss, if you remember him, they also condemned John Wycliffe, who had died, so they very maliciously took him out of the ground and burned him and scattered his ashes in the river. Well, William Tyndale was inspired by John Wycliffe, and he translated the Bible as well into English, but he used the Greek. So here we see a shift here. Translated the New Testament in 1526. He made a later revision, I think in like 1534. And then he did several portions of the Old Testament from Hebrew, but then he was betrayed by a friend and killed. Miles Coverdale eventually took over the works that he had and finished the Old Testament. Well, after about this time, we also have Henry VIII, who started the Church of England with a very unique, not very spiritual revival there, and had the first authorized English Bible under Henry VIII. It's called the Great Bible because it was so big. This Bible would have been chained to a pulpit, not everybody could have had access to. But it was a big Bible and could be accessed at church. The Geneva Bible was published shortly thereafter, and it was the one the Puritans loved and the version they brought to the United States. At that time, it was just the New World. Church of England produced the Bishop's Bible later in 1568, primarily a revision of the Great Bible. And here you see a picture of the Great Bible and also the Geneva Bible. Now, in these days, do I want to get there now? No, I'm not going to get there now. All right, we'll look at here the Lord's Prayer in a couple of these versions. So Wycliffe would have written this. You can kind of understand it. English has come pretty far. If you go on YouTube and listen to how it's originally said, it sounds pretty interesting and somewhat Germanic in tone. Tyndale's version is a little easier. Oh, our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, let thy kingdom come, thy will be fulfilled as well in earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, even as we forgive them which trespass us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. Now, before the King James Version, the Great Bible, the Bishop's Bible, and the Geneva Bible, and then the Catholic's Version, I remember, they were loaded with footnotes and commentary. Because, you know, initially people were afraid, you know, they're going to read this in their own tongue, people are going to come up with all these weird ideas, they're going to leave the church in droves, all kinds of weird heresy is going to come out. So if we have one Bible, we don't have to worry about this heresy, we tell them what to believe and they do it. All right, now they want their own language. We'll just load it with commentary to make them believe what we want them to. So all these Bibles had commentary, and depending on the king or the religious, so the political and theological persuasions of the day, some of them didn't like the footnotes because, well, that footnote says this, and that's coming against this church, and this is coming against this authority. And so they wanted to just do away with that. They felt like there was a need for a Bible without this commentary. When James I sent to the throne in 1603, he called for the Hampton Court Conference in 1604 to try to bring together various parties from within the Church of England. He wanted to have one Bible. He wanted to settle on the Great Bible, the Bishop's Bible, or the Geneva Bible, but he himself didn't like some of the commentary in these Bibles. And nobody would agree on these popular versions. And so they decided, we need a new translation. And we're going to do it these ways. We're not going to use marginal political commentary like the Geneva Bible. We're going to use the Bishop's Bible to be the base text, but we're going to check it against the Greek and the Hebrew. And we want the language to be dignified and suitable for public worship. We want to have a spirit of reverence that comes out through what is said. And around 50 scholars worked on this project. They divided it into six groups, if I remember right. Again, please cross-check me on everything I say. But they put them into these different groups. And these people were master scholars. No chat GPT. These guys knew, they knew Greek and they knew Hebrew very, very well. Now, Erasmus had 12 copies of Greek manuscripts. King James translators had 25. So double. It's great. And they were using primarily what is called the Textus Receptus for this. And while we have now over 100 Hebrew manuscripts, the King James translators had access to exactly two. So they got this translation out. It was a good translation. But immediately they understood that there needed to be some revisions. And so they underwent that 1611, I think you should say 1619 or 1617. Somewhere in the teens later on there was a revision. And they'd made multiple revisions. Now, I grew up in a King James only church, and I heard so many times, we stand on the 1611 King James Bible. It's fascinating to know that the 1611 King James Bible we have today is actually the 1769 version. Nobody uses a 1611. There are a few in libraries, and they cost, you know, a couple million dollars, but the 1769 version is what we use. It was a great translation for its day. Okay, don't get me wrong. It was a good translation and done by solid people. You may have seen a chart like this before, type of Bible translations. Whenever it comes to Bible translations, some people say, I want a word-for-word translation. I want something accurate to the text. And some people say, well, I want something that's a little bit more easy to understand. And so they have this, what some people call thought-for-thought. There's other more scientific-sounding words I could use for this, but for ease, let's just say it's word for word, thought for thought, and then paraphrase. Word for word is as close as we can to an actual literal word for word translation. I'll give you an idea of what that actually looks like. More thought for thought. So what would the early hearers have heard? And do the same hearers today hear what those people would have said? Try to get that same context in. And then a paraphrase, which is just kind of rounding out it all and trying to make it very easy to read and very loosely translated, if translated at all. Some versions are translated by committees, some are translated by individuals, and some use English texts, some use Greek and Hebrew. So it is wise when looking at a translation to see who translated it, where is it coming from. But you can see where the interlinear Bible. If any of you try to read one of those, it's difficult. It's still not exactly word for word. It's close. The New American Standard Bible is one of the most word for word translations we have that is also easier to read. Amplified Version, the English Standard Version. You see, the King James Bible actually is not the furthest along. That isn't necessarily bad, but some people think that that is the most word for word translation. So if you believe that, I just kind of want to put a hole in your ship. Thought for thought, that's where you get more like the New Revised Standard Version, the New American Bible, the NIV, is that New American Bible? NIV, New International Version. And then you keep going on. NLT is just at the point where it's not quite thought for thought, starting to get paraphrased right in the middle there. And the Message is about as paraphrased as you can get, unless you're reading the Cotton Patch Bible. All right, so here's a word for word translation of the Lord's Prayer. If it's in parentheses, that's just kind of a, in the Greek text, you get that feel. But if you're going to do word for word, just ignore it. So I'm going to read it without it, okay? Father of us that in the heavens, be sanctified the name you, come the kingdom you, be done the will you, as in heaven, also upon earth. The bread of us, the daily, give to us today, and forgive to us the debts of us, as also we forgave the debtors of us. And not may you bring us into temptation, but rescue us from the evil. Now recognize too, Uranus could mean heavens or could mean skies. The will, we could say, could be done, or be done the wishes of you. So there's other words that we could put into, but here's a kind of a word-for-word translation. I don't know about you guys, but I don't want this for my devotions. It's going to be pretty difficult. You know, eventually if I learn Greek enough to read the left side, sure. But in English, sometimes it's hard enough for me to stay focused. So let's look at some of these English versions, the ESV. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our debts as also we have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Sounds pretty much like the King James Version, and kind of like what we just read. The NIV, our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread. Forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. So the NIV, while the Greek does kind of push the idea that it is an evil being or something being evil, NIV takes that liberty to just go ahead and say evil one, whereas the ESV decides to do a more accurate just from evil. The NLT, our Father in heaven, may your name be kept holy. May your kingdom come soon. May your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today the food we need. Forgive us our sins as we have forgiven those who have sinned against us. And don't let us yield to temptation, but rescue us from the evil one. I think the NLT sometimes gives us a bit more of a feel of what the original hearers would have said. So I'll just admit, if I'm not reading the King James, the New American Standard Bible, or the ESV, I'll go to the NLT to get a new flavor. And I never go to the Message, although some Moody students love it. Our Father in heaven, reveal who you are. Set the world right. Do what's best. So above, so below. Keep us alive with 3 square meals. Keep us forgiven with you and forgiving others. Keep us safe from ourselves and the devil. You're in charge. You can do anything you want. You're a blaze in beauty. Yes, yes, yes. All right, I'm going to end with this. The purpose of Bible translation is simply to make the message of the Bible accessible and understandable to people in their own language, in their own cultural context, while being faithful to the original text. If we're not meeting this, then we should probably be looking for something a little better. There are a number of Bible translations out there. I think it's important for a family to be centered around one version for Bible memory and for Bible study as a family. But I also think it is wise to have access, especially with the internet, it's so easy with Bible Gateway or Blue Letter Bible to go into and explore other texts to just kind of get a better feel. I don't think you have to go back to the Greek if you don't understand any Greek to know what the text is saying. There's good English translations, and I just think it can be interesting to go into the Strong's Concordance, but just recognize that, for instance, give us our daily bread. Arthos, at times, oddly enough, can mean burden. We would never translate that way. But if you go to Strong's, you might actually see, oh, it could mean burden, and come up with some very interesting, but not very scripturally based sermon on give us the burdens we're supposed to bear every day. It totally missed the purpose of what the Lord's Prayer was trying to say there. But we do want to look at what we're able to understand with hopefully the same type of feel that the early people would have understood. You know, it's already enough to ask people to take up their cross and follow the Lord without also saying, now read a Bible, you're going to need a dictionary or two or three, and a lot of headache to get to understand. I do think the King James is a good version, but I also would say that we want to be careful that we're reading and teaching a book. You know what? I am going further than I meant to say. My apologies. I better just shut down right away. Okay. So we, and it's same for me when I go to, if Lord willing, you know, we work with ABT, we're able to do a Bible translation. Our goal is to try to look into the text and translate in a way that they're able to understand. We want to be very careful that, I want to be careful in saying everything I just said about this, all the whole of tonight. Do we know where the texts have changed? Yes. Does that mean we have any cause for fear? Not at all. The way that we can even see that there's changes gives us a foundation to say we actually know what it is. Are there a couple places we have some guesses? Yeah. But nothing that will shake our faith. Not one thing at all. And I hope that this doesn't scare you in any way, but rather encourage you to continue to dig into Bible study. And if you see in one, if you're using an ESV with a lot of footnotes, don't let it, you know, scary if it says missing in some Hebrew manuscripts. Sure, these manuscripts have been passed around for hundreds and hundreds of years. How many of our own paperback books have already lost the cover in the back five pages? Same thing happened back then. And just because it's missing from one doesn't mean it's missing from others as well. All right, with that, I'm going to close this. If you have other questions, feel free to ask me. I'm also happy to point you in directions. There's a lot of good research on YouTube. There's a lot of good research in various books, so I have access to both if you want anything like that. All right. Do we have any prayer requests?